This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our topic today on Keeping the Faith is the criminal justice system, and our guests are Aaron and Carol Ammons. Welcome.
Thank you
very much.
Now, you were founders, along with some other folks, of the Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. Tell me what motivated you to be involved in this kind of a movement.
When we got started initially, we began to work. A lot of people who were friends, me and Kim were one of them, and Aaron and Danielle, we all got together and decided that we was going to do something. At that time, the city of Champaign was discussing purchasing tasers. And we organized because we thought that that was not a necessity for our police department to have tasers, and all of the connecting deaths that had been recorded, we wanted to challenge their decision to purchase those items. And so we organized effectively with the Urban League at the time. We organized with medical students, as a matter of fact. We had just a wide range of people who worked on that particular issue. And by the grace, we were successful in convincing the new chief of police at that time, Chief Finney, to reconsider the purchase of those tasers. And so at that point, we decided, after that somewhat victory, that maybe we should work on some other social justice issues together. And we had a meeting and somehow came up with the name CU Citizens, because many of us were from Urbana and Champaign area, and we wanted it to be an inclusive type of movement. So not focused on one of the cities, but focused on the entire area. And so that's how we came about Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice.
Now, right now, one of your major concerns is the criminal justice system. And tell us what some of the key issues are in that for you and other people in your group.
Well, one of the key issues for us is just the mass incarceration of poor people, period. And as it pans out, it looks more like people of color who are primarily being targeted or being housed in these warehouses called penitentiaries, or I call them concrete plantations, as we know that the prison system is now becoming privatized. So that's one of the primary concerns that we have. We have concerns about the budgets, even of the public defender's office, for instance, in relationship to the state's attorney's office. Are the public defenders being equipped with the type of funds and the type of support that they need to adequately represent people who don't have the money to afford high-priced lawyers? There's a lot of different concerns with judges passing out sentences with personal bias and things of that nature, and doing some unethical things, and also the overcharging sometimes of particular cases where, for instance, obstruction of justice has become a major issue for us here lately. When one of the young men by the name of Terrell Layfield, who was one of the five young people who's died in the county jail over the past 2 years, he was actually sentenced to 6 years in the penitentiary for giving a false name. And this is an abuse of the law of obstruction of justice, because it was never designed to punish people for doing things of that magnitude. It was designed to stop people who were running from the police, who were throwing away objects, or who were destroying evidence, and, you know, things of that nature. But now it's being handed out as a mechanism to trump charges on individuals. So those are some of the major concerns that we have here.
Let's look at some of these issues that you raised singly. You mentioned first the mass incarceration. How many more people are going to jail now than in our recent past in this country?
Well, you and I had discussed that just a little bit. I always use this figure of 1965, we had 502,000 people in all the penitentiaries across the land of America.
1985.
No, 1965.
Was that 65?
That was 65. Okay. Yeah. 502,000 people. As of now, we have, in fact, in 1985, what she's alluding to, we had roughly a million people. Now we have an increase of, we have upwards of 2.1 million people in the penitentiaries now. And this mass incarceration that we're talking about stems from what is called the so-called drug war. And so the penalties that are being handed out, the mandatory minimums, the three-strike laws, things of that nature for low-level drug possession have taken people who are users and petty street dealers and have turned them into slaves, in essence, in the penitentiaries as they work for very minimal costs and produce products for big-time companies and organizations.
Now, the drug war that you referred to, when did that begin in this country?
I would say that it actually began probably a little bit before my time, around the early or late 70s. You know, I was born, but I wasn't working at that particular point, right? But it really came to head during in the 1980s and around about 1984, when the Reagan administration and the scandal with Oliver North and the Contras, as we found out through public documents that were printed in various different newspapers and various different services, where you can find out how the military was actually used to transport shiploads plane loads of drugs to the states from Colombia, Nicaragua, Bolivia, Peru, and places like that. And we knew that it came out that the Reagan administration was using that money to fund the Contras, to fund their revolution. And that's when once it began to flood the streets of the West Coast and began to also...
Of this country.
Of this country, of the United States, yes. And it began to spread throughout all other cities throughout the country and became an epidemic. Crack became an epidemic. Then there was something that had to be done about it. And what was implemented was this so-called war on drugs.
Well, if I can just back up just a slight bit on that issue. If you recall, the area, he's mentioned 1965, which is a critical time between 1965 and 1967 and 68. Prior to the movement of the 70s, where you have your Black Panther Party, you have Dr. King on the scene, you have Malcolm X on the scene, and at that time you also had J. Edgar Hoover on the scene. And what he did was he was using drugs to infiltrate and to destabilize, as destabilize the Black liberation movement of that time. And so that was one of that was part of the process before it actually hit the legislative edge in 1985, when Reagan them did the three strikes, you're out in California. You would notice that California is number one in mass incarceration of nonviolent offenders. And so all of this, what we see today, has its roots in directly tied into this government, the government's process, and the manipulation of the American people to believe that the people that they see on the corner, little peddlers of small amounts, is the problem of being unsafe in America. And so that's something that has a very terrible dichotomy and has people thinking of things that are actual illusions. And we have to concern ourselves more with the policies that create this atmosphere.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Carol Ammons, that you just heard speaking, and Aaron Ammons, who are part of the Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. And we're talking about that organization and some of its concerns, particularly the concern with the criminal justice system. And we've been talking about jails and the drug war that's led to so many folks being put in prison. Let me encourage listeners to join this conversation. This is a call-in show every week on WILL. And if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455 for a toll-free call. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. In Champaign-Urbana, we have several lines that can be accessed for our local listeners. Punch in 333-9455, 333-WILL for local calls. Eager to have listeners join in. Tell me a little bit. You both are young, particularly from my perspective. where were you growing up as teenagers, where you started seeing some of your friends perhaps get arrested? Where were you? Where were each of you?
Interesting. I didn't have any involvement at all, and or know anyone at that point that were incarcerated for drug selling or even drug using at that time. I was from Joliet. You know, I came up that way. I went to college. And
where did you go to college?
I started off in Joliet, and then I finished up at the Chicago State and transferred to the University of Illinois, finished my degree. And after that, I started living after that, I guess.
Here or in Chicago?
I did in Chicago, and then I transferred down here.
So your undergraduate degree ended up being from Champaign-Urbana?
Yeah, it ended up being from Champaign because I finished my last course here.
I see. And where would you have been, Aaron?
I got the PhD in the streets. I was here. I moved here when I was in like seventh grade. But I began, I guess, my involvement in starting to see firsthand from my father, actually. I was exposed to a lot of different activities that he was indulging in. And that's when I was introduced to it, and I saw people being shot. I was introduced to that whole beginning to see some of those things and around the drug life. And so as I got older and finished a couple years of Parkland playing basketball there, I took out into the streets myself. And that's when I began to see firsthand and began to be a dealer in myself and using and things of that nature. So I saw firsthand individuals who were extremely talented, who were extremely intelligent, who were poor and bought into the game of getting rich quick, and ended up getting this felony conviction for, you know, a half an ounce of cocaine or something like that, or a few bags of cocaine, and get sent to the penitentiary for 4 years or for 8 years. A really good friend of mine, it was very tragic for me, and we had played basketball together and did all sorts of things together, and when he was caught with selling drugs, he was given 8 years in the penitentiary, and I didn't see him for 4 years, and it began to really be an eye-opener for me, seeing how easy it was to get swept up into this into this barrage of this so-called drug war. And so I saw firsthand a lot. I mean, I can just go down the list, but I'm very much aware of the outcomes of these charges of this so-called drug war. And I'm also very aware of the accountability that each individual has for themselves in participating in that.
And where you were seeing this drug use and the people getting arrested for and serving major sentences for some of these nonviolent crimes was right here in Champaign County.
Oh,
in
yes,
Central
indeed.
Illinois.
Definitely.
Now, how did you get free of the hold of drugs, the attraction of drugs yourself?
Well, I had to go through about 8 years of using and selling myself. And when I came to grips, when I decided not to sell anymore, I found out that I was left with a tremendous habit of my own that I had to deal with. And it took me a few years to get past that.
Now, but was this cocaine?
Yes, it was actually marijuana and crack cocaine, mixing the two, as we used to call it, lacing the marijuana joints with crack cocaine, which was a fad during the early 90s. Believe it or not, in the ghettos and the low-income areas, because we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into, you know, when that crack epidemic swept through. So it was a very spiritual development for me. As I was down in the dumps, I had moved back to Chicago and actually was given a tape of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan from a friend of mine. And I went and sat down in the room, and it was as if he was chastising me. And I had a lot of things had built up to that point. I was really trying to quit, and I had thoughts of suicide and all kind of different things. And I just went upstairs and dropped down on my knees and said, you know, God, Allah, I cannot, I can't do this anymore by myself. And I want you, I need you to be the head of my life and all my decisions from this day forward. And I just, at that moment, I got this tingling sensation all over me. And I didn't wake up clean. I went back to using over and over, you know, off and on. But every day of my life since that point has been a steady progression towards peace and sobriety. And so at this point, I've been clean now for over 8 years.
When did you meet Carol?
Oh, the wow. Right in the heart of that. Early, was it 1999, 2000? When I was beginning the process, I had moved back from Chicago. And I was working. I was going to school at Parkland and working at a gas station on Kirby Avenue. And a gentleman walked in as I was reading W.E.B. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk. And he noticed that, and he asked me some questions about it. And he left, and he came back in and said, you know, I'm Dr. Pat Nizzi, and I work over at the Chanute Transition Center out in Rantoul, and we need someone like you to come in and work with our youth. And he told me to come in that Monday morning. I filled out the application, and before they knew what was going on, they I was already hired. So they went in, and I began to get CANTS clearance, FBI clearance, and all that type of stuff, and they allowed me to stay there and work. So it was that's where I met her. She was there working and had the tremendous respect of the young men who were there at this place in Chanute Transition Center. These were young men who had been to the juvenile detention center before. Some of them had even committed murders. They had drug charges, all kind of things, but they loved her dearly. And she said she saw in me that I loved them, and she knew I was her husband, and so that's where we met.
And Carol, do you want to describe that from your perspective?
What he said was all true. Because one of the things that I think Aaron had an opportunity to do, which was not by his own design, is that there was a greater purpose for him to serve. And even though he may not have known exactly what it was at that moment, the right circumstances would bring that out. And so as we began to communicate, I could easily see that his heart was good and he really wanted to do that which was good. He just needed the opportunity provided for him. And so as I think about what he said prior to you asking him the question about how we met, the people who are sent, the nonviolent offenders who go to prison for long extended sentences, they weren't violent offenders in the beginning. What they were doing was trying to come up with a get-rich-quick scheme that would allow them some economic stability, that which they don't find present in their environment. And so when they go to prison now, they learn what criminality is, because all of us know that the prison system is not a place of rehabilitation. It has not been that. It wasn't even designed in that way in its original form. And so people who go to prison who are not violent offenders, they learn how to manipulate the system even greater. So our recidivism rate as they are released is within 3 years. They are returned for some other additional crime, because we have to realize that they're not getting a new way of thinking in prison that will reshape their mindset and turn them away from that which is destructive to themselves and others. What they learn is they learn how to manipulate the system and how to continue in that same mindset. Nothing has interrupted the process. Aaron had an interruption in his process, which helped him turn all the way around 180 degrees.
One of the things that people often learn in prison is they experience violence there, and they become more violent themselves.
And a lot of them, when I talk to some young men who have had any particular time in prison, and usually it is for drug offenses, they are very hostile in their hearts. Their hearts are hardened, because what they see is you provide this mechanism. For instance, we make cell phones. And we make cell phones and everybody has one. Now we want to begin to pass legislation to criminalize the use of cell phone at certain times. So our society,
for drug use,
exactly. We produce these things for people to utilize, but then when they utilize them in a way that we don't feel is productive, then we want to criminalize them. And so that's a direction that this society is going in that is actually detrimental to the entire society, not just to those who are being incarcerated, but to those who are feeling that they have no responsibility connected to that incarceration.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that Aaron mentioned earlier was that people of color are way out of proportion in terms of the number of people who actually get arrested and convicted and serve prison times. Why is that?
Well, I attribute it to the prejudice and racism, as well as the economic deprivation that is still pervasive, especially for black people and people of color, as a fallout of slavery. Because in a society where education is supposed to be such a mechanism for us to gain economic stability and legitimate wealth, when you start off 250 years behind everybody else and you've been unable to read and your culture has been snatched from you, you're going to start off behind everybody else. And so now you're trying to get what everyone else has. And it's as if you're putting food in front of starving people. They're going to try to eat. And so I see the economic deprivation as one of the key catalysts to it. And there's a psychological aspect to this. When the Emancipation Proclamation and stuff was, when all that went down, there were, for many years in this country, no police departments. But once these so-called slaves were being freed, then these militia groups had to be organized into police departments. So there was a psychological profile put into place that says, we know that these slaves have a propensity to do certain things, so we'll make behaviors like domestic violence a felony so they can't vote, so we can disenfranchise them that way. And the 13th Amendment says that slavery is illegal everywhere in the United States except in the penitentiaries. So there's a game and a psychological, even as some people may call me a conspiracy theorist type of thing, but we know from studying advertisement and everything else that people react if you can get into their mindsets. And if you can see what they are predisposed to, they have a predisposition to do these particular things based upon their economic situation, then poor people are going to take this as a means and as a way for them to try to get some money, basically, is what it boils down to.
I want to get back to some of those issues, but let's go to a phone caller. We have someone on line one with a comment. Go ahead.
Yes. My point is that cell phones can be a blessing, but they can also be a curse. Can they clarify how they can be a blessing and how they can be a curse? That's my question. Thank you.
So one of the issues, Carol, you were bringing up was that cell phone use in some that there are some laws being considered, or are there already some laws in the books in some states that the use of cell phones for, is it just any criminal activity or particularly drug activity adds to the offense somehow?
Well, I'm not sure about the drug use. I do know that there's some conversation here locally about us passing a city ordinance in Urbana that would restrict the use of cell phones in cars. Totally to restrict the use of cell phones in cars.
And there's already that in Chicago, I think.
And in Chicago, actually, it's not a total ban. So that's where, and this is a different conversation, but that's where the debate is. In Chicago, you can use a cell phone as long as it's hands-free.
I see. Uh-huh.
You cannot hold a cell phone and drive in Chicago. It's supposed to be a hands-free system. Well, whether that works or not, you know, I don't know. I'm in Chicago, but what I would certainly advocate for, if we are discussing any type of ban that attaches penalty to it, that we would use something similar to what Chicago did, because I think it's a valid point. Certainly, you can be distracted in a car while talking on a telephone and holding it and trying to dial and things of that nature. So that is a very valid point. But at the same time, you would put in place, as so many laws we have on the books, that cannot be administered fairly. And so we go back to the issue of racial profiling, which was an issue. We have the highest rate in our counties, in Champaign County, of racial profiling in the state. And so you want to be careful when you put in policies that cannot be administered equally.
Some of our listeners may not know exactly what you mean by racial profiling. Explain that a bit.
Racial profiling is I'm sure the police departments use them for lots of different ways to profile people to try to figure out who has done what. But in the case of the Department of IDOT's report, which is the Illinois Department of Transportation, what they have required the police departments to do is to turn in their numbers each year to show the level of stops that are being made for Black people versus white people and the rest of the population that exists in that county. And so what we've seen over the last 2 years, which they've only had 2 years of reports that they've done, but within those 2 years of reports, that Black and minority drivers in Champaign County have been stopped for things such as taillights out, things hanging from their visor, pretenses for drug searches is what they call phishing, which is an unofficial term that the police department use when they're using these stops as a pretense to find drugs or criminal activity. That is considered racial profiling.
You know, Steve, if I could, I wanted to touch on that racial profiling piece and kind of finish the answer to the question you asked me about the why so many Black people or people of color in the penitentiaries. I spoke to it from an economic standpoint, and I tried to articulate that the best I could. It just boils down to who has and who has not, you know, as to why many people choose that particular life. But you also have people who are drug users who have a hopeless sort of mindset or very apathetic because of the condition, overall condition of people, especially of Black people. And have been enticed by, as many of us have, we have habits of, you know, cigarettes, coffee, and other drugs as well. As a friend of mine says, what's your DOC, your drug of choice? And some of them are legal and some of them are not. And so those who have the habits of cocaine and heroin or marijuana and things of that nature, or methamphetamines, not so much methamphetamine, but they have a... They get caught with, you know, a bag of this or a small amount of that, and they end up in the penitentiary as well. And that is one of the biggest areas of that big boom and that mass incarceration is people who are actually users who are end up also associated with that with that boom in the population because they end up stealing or boosting and robbing and things of that nature, and it gets connected
for their
to
habits.
It.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have there's an article called White Boys Loaded, which shows that the society, the population of our society is still basically seven out of 10 people are still Caucasian people in the United States, and they use far more drugs than anyone else. However, the numbers of incarceration don't match the population, kind of like the racial profiling thing does. And what you see is that when you have judges, there are no Black judges in Champaign County. And people...
And all of them are Republican, I believe.
Right, except I believe.
I believe they're all Republican.
And so what you have is a tendency...
Class.
And a class issue of, well, here's another white man in front of me who's got a drug problem, and I'll give him a slap on the wrist because he got caught with powder. But now this young African-American that comes before me who got caught with crack, because the laws are 10 to 1 or 7 to 1 in relationship to sentencing with powder and with crack.
And these are both forms of cocaine.
Both are forms of cocaine. Mm-hmm. Crack cocaine has to be cooked. And the powder cocaine has to be mixed with a baking soda substance and cooked at a high temperature and formed into its what they call the purest form or crack. So the laws on crack have been put on the books to be stiffer. And many people from a certain perspective say, well, that is racist or prejudice within itself, based upon the history of most Caucasian people using powder cocaine as opposed to crack cocaine. So those are some of the things that contributed to it. Then when I speak of a prejudice or a race aspect of it, that these judges still have the discretion to issue these particular sentences. And you still also have an economic issue where most of the individuals who may be selling drugs who are Caucasian have enough money to pay for a lawyer to get their sentences reduced and get the charges brought down.
As a matter of fact, if I can just give one instance of that as an example.
Sure.
In the News Gazette about maybe about a week or two ago, there was a young man who had been arrested, and he was in possession. As a matter of fact, he was a university student who had been arrested for sending drugs in the mail. And it was intercepted. The where it came from, the Postal Service had notified the authorities, and they arrested him on this end of it here in Champaign. And he had marijuana and powdered cocaine mm-hmm. that was in this package that was coming to his dorm room, apparently. He's trying to use another student to receive it, but anyway, it was about him. They arrest him. And in the News Gazette, they printed this story, and they had dropped the more serious charge of the cocaine, and it was quite a bit.
Well, he had like half a pound.
It was
cocaine.
Like it was a lot, like
8 or 9 ounces or so. Mm.
They had dropped that, and given him a lesser sentence on the marijuana possession, and so these are disparate sentencing. When you see, of course, poor people in the poor communities who have less, as you read the News Gazette, if you keep up with any of this, you'll see not even enough to sweeten your coffee of grams, but will require 12 and 15 years in prison. Not that they should be doing this in the beginning, but we're talking about the application of the law, due process and equity. And that is what is missing from the criminal justice system in Champaign County and throughout this country.
I want to get back to that in just a minute, but we're about halfway through the program. You're listening to Keeping the Faith here on WILL, a radio service of the College of Communications of the University of Illinois. And, of course, we're a listener-supported radio station and want to encourage listeners to, at this time of year, during the fall pledge season, to remember to make contributions that are so needed to continue help for WILL, since so much of the budget must come from listener support. So if you'd like to make a donation, please do so. It's very important. Mm-hmm. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I'm the executive director of the University YMCA, and support for Keeping the Faith is provided in part by the Y. The Y is the oldest student organization that's been continually active on campus. We've been at the University of Illinois since 1873, helping develop student leaders by providing opportunities for social action, for community service. We have literally hundreds of college students who, in addition to working on their own degree and preparing for their own professional life, take time to help others in the process. And the Y has been helpful to students to do helping them do that for, lo, these 133 years. So I'm happy to be a part of that. Coming up at the Y this week are some public lectures that people might be interested in. On Tuesday, as part of the Know Your University series, we have Beth Amsbury, who is an alum of the Department of Theater at the university and the founding artistic director of the Seattle Public Theater. And she'll be talking about Corn Community and Tales of Delightful Growth. That's this Tuesday at noon at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street. Easily accessible by bus, and you can occasionally even find parking spaces around noon as students are leaving that area. Friday also at noon, our Friday Forum lecture this week. The whole series has been on ecology and the importance of the environmental movement. And Jonathan Eckhind, who's a former U.S. national security expert, will be speaking on energy security and U.S. policy. That's Friday at noon, October 20, at the University Y. The lectures, of course, are free, and people can come and listen. You can bring your own lunch, or you can call in and reserve a lunch or buy one when you get there from our Thai restaurant. If you want to reserve a lunch, do call 337-1500, 337-1500. Communiversity classes at the Y, non-credit classes and all kinds of things. The second session is starting up for this semester tomorrow. If you'd be interested in learning about ballroom dance, Miss V is back on her feet and able to teach now after her knee surgery, and so that'll be starting up tomorrow. Beginning ballroom dance, intermediate, tango, mambo. Give the Y a call if you'd like. You can just show up, and these courses are very reasonably priced. There's also courses in photography and cooking and various martial arts and various spiritual practices and all kinds of things. So check out our website, universityymca.org. We have a caller who's patiently waiting to talk to our guest, Carol and Aaron Ammons, about the criminal justice system. Go right ahead.
Thank
yes,
you.
Line number one. Chris. Yes.
Hello. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Good, thank you. Steve, thanks a lot for having this program. It seems that nobody wants to really talk about criminal justice. When they should. It's the front line of our government, and it's every day. If people don't think this is a big deal, consider that $13 million a year is spent by the Champaign County on maintaining its criminal justice system. That would be the courthouse, the jail, the sheriff's department, the public defender's office, and the state's attorney's office. That comes to $13 million a year. Champaign, the city of Champaign spends about $9 million a year on their law enforcement. And the city of Urbana is up to now $7 million a year. So this is a big deal. And I would like to just echo the guests and their claim that the criminal justice system is racist. It really is. When you look at those sentences every week in the News Gazette, you can see the difference. And when it's a white defendant and it's a black defendant, you certainly have to, the law enforcement likes to hide behind, we don't pick the race of the guy that commits the crime. But what law enforcement will not own up to is that they have the discretion where they patrol. They have the discretion on whether or not they want to make the arrest. For instance, you can just pour it out, or I can arrest you for underage drinking. They have the discretion whether or not to prosecute. They can decide whether or not to go forward with the charges, or drop the charges, or offer a plea bargain. So when you look at who's going to prison, it's predominantly black folks. And that's just the fact. It's been that way for 40 to 50 years that I'm aware of in Champaign County. And the excuse that it's like that everywhere is not good enough for me anyway. But, Steve, I wanted to ask you a question because the penitentiary and the criminal justice system. And you have to put the drug war in context of the campus bar explosion as an economic development tool. But, Steve, here's the question I'll have, and I'll get off the line and let others chime in here. But you've worked with the poor for a lot of years, I would say almost two decades that I'm aware of. How many of the folks that would come to the shelter had convictions? How many of the guests at the men's emergency winter shelter were ex-cons, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thank you for the call and for the questions and for the statistics on the amount of money that is spent on the criminal justice system here in Champaign and Urbana in the cities and in the county. In terms of the homeless shelter that you were asking about, when I was pastor at McKinley Presbyterian Church, for about 15 or 16 years, we had what is now called the Times Center shelter there. And it's true that many of the people who were homeless were people who had served time in the penitentiary and certainly in the county jails. Some of them were mentally ill. Some of them were addicted to alcohol or the drugs. And some were poor. And I don't know the percentages. I couldn't tell you accurately how many, but it was by far the majority who had served time. And as our guests today have indicated, it's very hard to get rehabilitated. It's very hard to have some of those problems solved by serving time in prison. So it's a continuing problem, and some of the poorest of the poor are some of the ones who are often going back and back to serve time for various offenses. We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Carol Ammons and Aaron Ammons from the Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. We're talking mainly about the criminal justice system and particularly the problems with racism, with drugs. If you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, do give us a call. 1-800-222-9455 is the toll-free number. Anywhere the program is heard in the continental U.S., you can call that toll-free. That's 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, there are two or three local lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Carol, I wanted to follow up on something you were saying before the break and before that last phone call. You may have forgotten, but I was making a note here, and our last caller, it does fit with his concern. That is just the cost of the criminal justice system and how much is spent on it. And I know when I was on the county board for a while, it was clear that over half of the whole budget for the county was spent on the criminal justice system. And it just keeps growing and growing and growing. And right now there's an issue of whether we should build another jail because the jail isn't big enough. And you started to talk about that, I know, earlier, and we got interrupted. What?
Well, one of the things that was just brought to my attention on that issue, when you're talking about, and I'm glad that it was brought to me because this is an election period that we're in. When you are running for office, as you just mentioned, being on a county board, and the majority of the budget of the county board is spent on criminal justice, when you're running for those offices, the majority of the citizenry want to hear things that makes them feel as the moral right, if you will, that our protection as citizens have to come at stiffer penalties for whatever it is that we decide is the breaking of the law. And so you have a conservative view of the system as where they are just criminals. They broke the law, so they went to prison. And in reality, that is not the case. Because so-and-so got caught doesn't mean that the other 99% of the population didn't break the same law at some point in time. So we kind of lose the focus of what is right and what is wrong when we take the position of the moral principle and we use that to be the judge and the jury in these cases. And so your prison population continues to increase. Because we've never dealt with the reason why people commit crimes in the first place. And so we advocate that not only does Champaign County rethink its position when it comes to criminalization of any group of people, but when it comes to dealing with the prison population, the concept of new prisons being necessary, if we would deal with some of the things that create crime, for instance, you've had a lot of experience in this. We understand that people are unemployed. And when they're unemployed, in many cases, they're uneducated as well, which leads to their unemployment. And so if they have addictions on top of that, keeping a job becomes even more difficult. Back in the 1980s and 90s, the push was mental health services. where people were able to get help for the drug addictions. Now there's no money for that because we move continually to a privatized prison system that does not have room or space for people to be rehabilitated because, frankly, we produce more products out of the prison system than we do in America as a whole. And so we send all of our work overseas for low wages, but some brilliant person has come up with a way that they can stop sending their. And they know it's not feasible to continue this type of business to send your outsource your labor, where in America you can privatize your prisons, continue to put laws on the books that criminalize people, and thereby increasing your free labor source.
We have a couple callers waiting. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Is it my turn?
Yes, line number one.
Line one. Okay. My question is, if people don't get drug treatment in prison and they can't get it in their communities because there's no money for mental health services, and what do they do? How do they get it, or do they get it at all?
I think that's an excellent question. What we've seen, as the caller prior to you suggested, that many of them do not get assistance with their drug addictions. Therefore, they are going to be repeat offenders, recycling back into the prison population.
You know, I saw a lady today as I was driving home who I knew and who I used to sell drugs to, you know, 20 years, 15 years ago, you know, and she's still doing the exact same thing. And I know that she's been in and out of the penitentiary for I don't know how long. And that it is, it's like you're left to fend for yourself, you know, like this moral position where you shouldn't have gotten yourself in this position. So now you get yourself out of it. And if there are no programs to help, if there are, there's no money there to support it, and the money is being put into
war,
to war, and all kind of war, right? You know, drug war, war on terror, and then the people are going to continue to do this. And that is, there's no other conclusion to come to other than that's what the establishment wants, that we want this free labor source again. With the Constitution saying that slavery is legal in the penitentiaries, and you're putting these laws on the books, and there's no money to help people who have these problems, there's no money being put into really into education so that people will choose education over drug dealing, then you tell me what you're trying to get out the deal. You know?
Now, you had said earlier on this program that in the first part of it that Reverend Louis Farrakhan of one of the branches of Islam, the Muslim movement, had been, a tape of his had been helpful to you when you're in that kind of situation to break out. And, of course, there are other religious groups, other private groups who help people break the addiction to drugs and help people out of help people out of poverty. And there are some government programs that do fund mental health services and things like the Prairie Center. We have several callers waiting. Let's go to line number two. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Aaron and Carol Ammons. Go ahead.
Good evening. Very intriguing show. As someone who has been a social service provider, but for stress reasons has recently gone into middle school education, this is something everybody should care about. Because, first of all, this is something I feel. I live in the Old Town area. Our town and all towns tend to go, well, that area there, this area here, hey, that's my neighborhood you're talking about, okay? When, you know, people go, well, they live in that neighborhood. Well, you're talking about my neighborhood as well. So there's that total fragmentation, and I think that's where we get to the economic injustice, and which leads to social injustice, because if we look at a single issue, such as the way our criminal court system works, the main breakdown, I think, besides maybe some obvious bias in who gets arrested or who gets picked on, is the way that the difference between, say, an extremely low-income person versus a low to middle-income person gets treated in the judicial system. People are not aware of the fact that perhaps someone charged with a domestic battery who is a middle-class individual is going to get conditional a conditional bench sentence. They, in fact, may not ever receive a felony conviction because it's all dealt with at a non-punitive level.
Right.
And when it comes to plea bargaining and the ability to plea bargain and the ability to continue a case for, say, 3.5 years, you know, economics has an obvious impact on just this one area of our justice system. And I think people forget, this is my feeling, it doesn't really fall around racial lines. It falls down socioeconomic lines. And I think everybody does get confused with the morals, and there is racism, but it's a lot of it is socioeconomic prejudice, which applies to people regardless of who they are, if they're low socioeconomic status. So I think we all need to work for economic justice and remembering that our neighbors are our neighbors. It doesn't matter what side of town you live on, what kind of neighborhood you live in. We all live in this place together. So thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the comments. We have another caller waiting with a comment or question on line number 3. Yes, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to know how the sentencing guidelines fit into all this.
Okay. Well, the sentencing guidelines say that, for instance, with the mandatory minimums that are on the books now, they say, well, if you get caught with 5 grams of crack cocaine in some states, you have to do an automatic 5 years in the penitentiary. And that's whether or not it was your first offense, second offense, or third offense, which is why we are advocating for this SMART Act bill and the hearing that's coming up October 27th at the Urbana City Council Chambers at 4:30 p.m. To 7 p.m. You can come and get a full understanding of what the drug school is about, because it'll speak to the issues of sentencing. It will speak to the guidelines of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine and things of that nature. And there's a website that you can go to that will actually give you much more in-depth information about the question that you have. That's efficacy, E-F-F-I-C-A-C-Y, now, efficacynow.org. And you can get a tremendous amount of information from there about the sentencing guidelines and the just anything that you want to have answered about the so-called drug war.
And the public hearing you mentioned is at the Urbana City Council October 27. At what time again?
We will begin at 4:30. From 4:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. will be a reception, and the hearing will begin. Will start at 5 until 7.
And if I can just, as we close down at the end of this hour, for those who are maybe just tuning in or who have been listening, the public hearing that Aaron just mentioned is an opportunity for the broader community to come out and get some of your questions answered, or even if you don't have questions, what is the SMART Act and what will it do? One of the things that we talked about through the course of this program is how do we divert people from the criminal justice system? How do we reduce the amount of people in recidivism? And so this act will help in lowering the amount of people that are going into incarceration. Instead of sending them to the prisons, we want to send them to a place where they can begin to deal with the thought process and the mentality that creates the criminal conduct and activity.
Let's try to sneak in one more caller. We just have a couple minutes. Line number 1, go right ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to piggyback what the other earlier caller had said. We're not sure whether it's class or race that are driving the biases in our county, but we need to understand that I think the caller is dead on, that it does start with economic injustice and, you know, lawyers wanting to be paid. They're going to more for a client that pays than a client that does not pay. But it really endangers all of us when it's a system like that, because when you let a dentist, a middle school teacher, an Urbana police officer,
right,
and others, you know, get away with sexually molesting or raping people, and that is they got probation or the charges were not even brought forward, that leaves a lot of people on the street that shouldn't be. And certainly we have to look at 100 rapes on campus every year, and we never get any prosecution. Why? Because they don't want to send white people to prison. That could be the reason. Or because they have the money for great lawyers who make backroom deals with each other. So I'll close with this. The really sick irony of all this is that 75% of inmates who go to prison use drugs while in prison.
There is
no drug-free prison. In fact, your star basketball player, Irwin Small, got 5 years in 1995 for delivering, as a prison guard, drugs to the Danville Medium Security Prison. But we have no drug-free prisons to begin with, so I'll leave it at that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call.
You know, Steve,
last comments?
Yeah.
We're down to about our last 30 seconds.
I wanted to touch briefly saying that my position on the racial profiling is also dealing with this. It's very much connected to the drug war concept, because these police departments are getting orders from the top to crack down on this. And since the profiling itself puts them in a position where they see these young black males or people in poor in particular communities, then they crack down on them. And the other thing that's a concern for us as CU Citizens for Peace and Justice is what the caller just touched on, was the personal preferences. When you have officers who have physical evidence of rapes and they are never even charged, because the perception is because they are friends with the now state's attorney, Julia Reitz. These things are when Brian Silverman is charged by his clients for sexual misconduct and he's never brought forth on charges. There begins to be an appearance of the same old good old boy racist network that's in place, and that my friends will not be charged. Only the individuals whom I choose use my discretion to charge. So those are some of the things that we're very much concerned with, because we want justice for everyone.
And if I can just say in closing, we want to invite those out who are listening to come out to Urbana City Council Chambers, which is 400 South Vine Street, October 27th at 4:30 p.m. There will be a public hearing held to discuss the issue of drugs, drug reform, and the drug school that is being proposed in our state legislation.
Our guests today have been Carol Ammons and Aaron Ammons from the Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. I want to thank them for being on the program, as well as our guests.
Thank you.
Our guests who called in today. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, Professor Matt Bolton of Andover-Newton Theological Seminary will be our guest, talking about the use of American traditional music in worship. My name is Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Richard Dawkins may be the world's best-known atheist. A renowned biologist, he's now written his atheist manifesto called The God Delusion. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll talk with Richard Dawkins about why he thinks belief in God makes no more sense than belief in Thor, Apollo, or the Flying Spaghetti Monster. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana.
This Thursday morning at 7, you can help WILL keep you better informed about the world, the nation, and our community. I'm station manager Jay Pierce. We'll be trying to do a full day's fundraising in just 1 hour. That's a single hour of fundraising for the entire day. Together, we can raise the money needed to bring you the programs you value with as little interruption as possible. So join us Thursday morning at 7 and make your pledge then. And thanks.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with a chance of rain after midnight. Not as cool, with a low in the mid-40s and southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers likely with a high in the upper 50s and southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, showers likely with a low in the upper 40s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.